Hi, well, welcome back. So in this next session, I'm going to build on what Rob was talking about in the previous one. We're going to dig a bit deeper into some of the anatomy of a Silverlight app. So what this is the third session of the day. It's called Advanced. I said at the beginning, it's more like essential Silverlight. So it builds on top of the basic stuff that Rob is teaching. But this is all the stuff you really have to understand if you're going to be creating Silverlight apps on Windows Phone. So not so much advanced as kind of, pretty much essential to know stuff. So in this particular one, we're going to be looking just very briefly again at the project templates. But the main meat of this session is talking about the application bar, which is the way that a user navigates around an application. The little strip at the bottom with buttons on that a user can tap on to navigate around through your application. So we're going to look at how that works and some of the design implications of navigating through this mechanism. And of course, that is about page navigation. We're talking about going from the home page of your app to other pages and how your user moves around the different pages in your application. I then want to talk about data binding, which is a technique for making your code better organized and cleaner so that you're not really setting properties of controls directly from your code behind, but through a data class you can actually bind your UI to a data class and have changes automatically move between them. So a user can enter something into a control and it automatically updates the backing data class, and vice versa. You know, your code will update the data class and it's reflected in the UI. So that's data binding. And then I'm going to look at the Silverlight toolkit, which is a whole bunch of extra controls that add on in addition to the ones you get out of the box in the toolbox. So just a quick review of these project templates first. Rob has already been through these. And each of these maps onto a particular style of application. So as Rob was saying, that the key ones that we were interested in, the Windows Phone application, Windows Phone data-bound application, which is a good example, a very good example of data binding, and it's a good one to study if you want to understand how that works. And then we've got things like the Panorama application and the Pivot application, and then the more specialized ones as well. So these are the ones, and of course the class library is the one with no UI, which is intended to contain reusable classes. So these are the building blocks of your applications. I'm going to look at the first sample. We're going to look a little bit more at the Pivot application and see how that works in an application, to see you can get a feel for the user experience of that. So again, a refresh of this. So the basic one is just a single page app. The one in the middle there is a data bound app that has two pages in it. So you can tap on an item in the list, and it's a master detail kind of one. So you'll navigate to the child page as well. And the third one on the right is an example of a Panorama app. These are the three kind of applications. So we've already been through that. Just a quick refresh on that. The only one of those that actually has distinct pages is the second one, and that allows you to tap on an item in the list and it'll navigate to the child page. But in applications, more often than not, you're going to see the application bar at the bottom with icons on it, which is the primary way of navigating through your application. So let's look at that application bar and how you program it. So just first of all, let's look at this is the makeup of a page. So you can see that we've got the system tray at the top, and that has things like the battery indicator, has the signal strength, these kind of things. That's in the system tray, the bit that appears at the top. You can turn that off. In the XAML at the top of a page, there's already some XAML in there that is showing the system tray, but you can turn that off if you want a full screen app. And as you can see there, it's microsoft.phone.shell.systemtray.isvisible. You can just set that to false, and that will be hidden from you, from the user. But then down at the bottom, you have this application bar. So you have up to four buttons on there you can put, and then you can also have an additional pop-up menu underneath it for less common tasks. So this is the way that you provide your navigation for your users. It's easy to use. You don't need to have to write any your own custom navigation in your app. So there's an example of an application bar with three buttons on it. One to send mail, one for attachments, and one to delete. And like I said, up to four buttons plus an optional menu. So you don't have to use all four if you don't need to. And you swipe up the bar in order to bring up the menu.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning too that the buttons will change colour to match the particular colour scheme you're using on the phone, which is rather nice too.
Indeed, yes. I'll show you in a minute in a demo actually what the icons look like. They are a white foreground on a transparent background, which is kind of hard to see when you're developing. But interestingly also, one thing we haven't mentioned at the moment with Windows Phone is that there are two essential themes, one with a black background and the other is with a white background.
Dark and light.
Yep, dark and light background. So, and actually it doesn't matter with the app bar icons, you still always use the white buttons because the system will automatically colour them white or black depending on what the current user-selected theme is. So here's the XAML for an application bar. You can see here that reading down from the top, the top XAML there is just the header declarations that you'll see on any page. And then a bit further down you have the phone application page dot application bar. And you can see the hierarchy of objects in there. The name is the name of this is app bar, and is menu enabled equal true, so the user can swipe it up and see an additional menu of menu items. And in there, we've got, in the application bar.buttons section, we've got two application bar icon buttons defined. So those are the round buttons that you'll see on the bottom of the screen. And then further down, we've got the shell application bar.menu items, and these are the text menu items that are only visible when the user taps on the three little dots, the ellipsis that you'll see on the right-hand side of the application bar, which exposes the additional menu items that are underneath. So, like I said, use those menu options for things that are less used.
This is part of the design we're talking about, isn't it? That basically...
Yep.
Pick what buttons need to go there. These are the ones that the users expect to find very easily to hand.
That's right. The application bar also has built-in support for landscape, so you don't have to worry about that. If your app supports landscape format, as Rob was explaining in the last hour, the application bar will get painted up on the left-hand side there rather than on the bottom, so it's making maximum use of the screen real estate there. So it puts it on the start, and you get a very nice built-in rotary animation as it realigns.
That,
it's very nice.
Had quite a good question from Damien. He's asking, do we have to consider different screen resolutions when building the apps? This is a good question. And the answer is no, as far as I'm aware. It's basically we have a single 480 by 800 screen at the moment, and everything in Silverlight is kind of scaled to fit. The units that you use in Silverlight are not actually tied to the screen resolution as such.
No, that's right. And so at the moment, all the phones that are out there are the single resolution. That's not to say that won't change, of course, in the future. There might be smaller screen resolutions and, of course, bigger ones. But you can still design your XAML today in confidence that it will work on a different resolution because the thing about XAML is you can apply these things called transforms.
Yeah.
That can apply across the whole of your page, for example. So you can actually sort of scale everything up by a factor of 1.5 or whatever. So it will automatically resize. I say we're not in that situation today. It's not necessary, but when it does come, the Silverlight layout system has everything we need to handle that without it being too painful an experience. Moving on the application bar, you can also set an opacity on the application bar. So on this example, on this screenshot here, you can see that the application bar there, the background of it, is semi-opaque. So you can see the text through it. You could make it completely invisible. So that might be appropriate for your application so that you have that option as well. And more often than not, what happens when you press one of these is that you might navigate to another page or something like that. Now, this is one of those things that Visual Studio is kind of okay for building application bars, but definitely this is one of the things I always switch into Expression Blend for, because Expression Blend makes building application bars a breeze. And it's mainly about these exposing the standard icons. So in Expression Blend, you get this drop down here, this menu. You can just pick and select the one you want of all the standard icons. There are a load of them, and mostly for most of the applications, one of the standard ones is going to fit your needs. You can, of course, create your own custom ones.
This is called the Noun Project, where you can get loads and loads as well. There's a website you can go to, which we'll put a link to, where you can get loads and loads. They've even got things like mummies and all kinds of strange stuff. So if you want a nice black and white icon, good place to go. I'll link to it on my blog.
All right. So I'm going to do a demo of that in a minute, but it's kind of in isolation. It's not terribly exciting because, like I said, what it's really often used for is navigating between pages or also saving data, anything that needs the user to explicitly say, oh, I want this to happen. It might be a good option for an application bar button rather than a button that's actually embedded in your main UI. So that's a design decision for you, of course. Now let's look at the frame and page navigation story. So there is this invisible, if you like, frame that there's one of them for your application. And within that, at any one time, in the frame, you display one page. And a page could have user controls inside it, and of course a page or a user control, as Rob showed you in the last one, contains a whole tree of Silverlight objects. But there's one page in the frame at any one time, and then when we switch to another page, the one page is thrown out and the new page is loaded in. But the frame stays there as the top level object that is the container for all of this stuff. So the frame also has the page control and the system tray and the application bar. And then your page has the content that you are developing for your application. So it's very similar in Silverlight on Windows Phone. It's very similar to a page-based navigator, similar to a web page model. So we actually do, each page's navigator is identified by a URI. And you have to develop, each page is essentially stateless. So there are techniques for passing data from one page to another, but they are necessarily fairly limited. And you should kind of, if you've got a web sort of mentality for this, that's a pretty good starting point, that a page should be self-contained and is stateless. Of course, you can have a data class that is common across your whole application. But equally, or you could simply pass some textual data across in the query string, and I'll show you how that happens in a moment.
Yeah, if you keep a web hat on, that's fine, because the pages are very much like web pages in that respect.
Yep. So you can navigate forward to a URI for page 2, or page 3, or page 4, or whatever in your application. And of course, when you are on a page, so as you navigate through from your starting page, which is usually called main page in a default application, and then you add additional pages, the Silverlight system is building up a navigation history, a stack, just like a web page. So as you go to the next page, it puts a new entry into the navigation history stack. So you end up with main page on the bottom and then page 1 on above that. And then in the history stack, you might have page 4 above that, depending on how the user has navigated through your application. You can actually go back through that history any time. So the bottom key on the bottom of the hardware of the phone, the back arrow there, is the hardware back key. And that always goes back. You can also go back by doing it in code, by calling navigationservice.goback. So that has the same effect.
It's nice because users are used to browsing the web like that. And so they know how to use your phone apps because they're going to behave the same way.
And it's one of the distinguishing features of Windows Phone from a usability point of view. People who go to other phones are sort of looking for the back key, and they're not available in other ways.
When I use an iPhone, I'm pressing the piece of the plastic where the back button should be, and nothing's happening. I'm getting cross.
So the hardware back key does that. It's with no code required, or you can do it in code with navigationservice.goback.
There's a question we've had from John. How many pages are stored in the back stack? Is there an upper limit?
I don't think there's a limit. You can keep on going. Most applications, if you're starting to get to more than 20 pages, you've probably got a design issue.
It's like using 4D arrays. Yeah. If you're using a 4D array in your program, it might be that there's a better way of structuring data. So I think the answer is the limit would be one of usability rather than one of the machine itself.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Now, the when you, like I said, when you press the back hardware key, it is implicitly a navigation service go back without you having to write any code. But there are occasions when that actually isn't what you want to happen, from, and your user would not expect that to happen. For example, if your page is currently displaying a pop-up on top of the main page, so the main page might be visible behind and you've got a pop-up displayed, a window displayed on top of it, then hitting the back key would actually, unless you intercept it, would cause the whole page to be closed and go back to the previous page. But the user would probably expect the pop-up to disappear.
Yeah.
So in this case, you need to write some code to override the back hardware key.
Yeah, the line really is make the system do what you think the user should expect at that point.
Yeah.
And you'll be fine.
Yeah, and the way you do this is you simply have to hook the back key press event, which is an event on the page, on the phone application page, which you can hook it up. You can actually express what the event handler is in XAML, as shown here, and in the top block of XAML on your page, and that's saying that when you get the back key press event, then actually you go to the event handler called phone application page underscore back key press, which is in, of course, in your C# code beside file. And then in your code, you, depending on the logical state of the page at the time, you can set e.cancel to true, which would stop the built-in default navigation. So actually, this isn't a great example. Typically, you would say something logical would be, is pop-up visible, then cancel the back key,
yeah.
or hide the pop-up rather than actually navigate back from the page. But essentially, this is the mechanism by which you can capture those back key presses and override them if needs be. So I said that pages are essentially stateless. So how do you pass data from one page to another? Well, a page is expressed as a URI, and as with the web, you can put a query string on it, which essentially is some text. So here you can see we're navigating to secondpage.xaml, and then there's a query string being added to it with question mark msg equals, and then some text that is reading out of a text box control. So that is being passed from the originator page to second page. And then how do you get at that in the second page? Well, you have to type in Visual Studio, type in override, and it will give you a number of methods you can override in that class. And the one you want is on navigated to. So this fires when you navigate into the page. And so in there, you can put some code like you can see on the bottom there. If navigation context.querystring.trygetValue, and then you're looking for a query string with a key of message, so MSG in this particular example. If that is in the query string, then you can pull that value out and then act on it in the logic of your new page. So that's one. That's a simple way of passing data onto another page. Now, often you want to... formatting's got a bit mangled on this. I apologise for that. But often you'll pass a data object from one page to another. So... here's an example in the DataBound project where you navigate to another page. Again, you put something into the query string, param equals equals, and then some value. But that might be an index into a data collection. So your view model, which we're going to come to in a minute, which stores your data, would be defined in your app.xaml.cs class, and is global to you. That's how you define sort of global objects that are global to your application.
Yeah. App.xaml is a page that you never see, but it acts like a sort of parent container for your whole system.
Yeah.
And everybody can. And app.xaml gets control when your program starts up. You can put code in there for that. And it also, as Andy says, it's a really solid place to put all the stuff your program's working on, because all the pages can find out their parent app.xaml file, and they can then pull information from them. In fact.
Yeah. Well, I'll be showing an example of this in just a minute.
We're doing that later.
Now then, there is an interesting thing about the navigation system. So you do need to design your app navigation strategy carefully. So this kind of reflects on that comment, the question we had earlier about how big can the navigation stack be. Above all, you've got to make sure your navigation in your app is logical to your user. You don't want an annoyed user who ends up deep in some page hierarchy and can't get out again. So, and there is an essential problem in that if you think, consider an example where you start on main page. Oh, we had another question actually, which I haven't. If you hit back, how do you exit
There's
an app?
There's a fantastic question from John. How do you pass data back from a page?
How do you what?
Pathé to back from a page. When you press the back button, how do you get information from that page into the one that you're turning to?
Well, you wouldn't do that because you could set, if you've got a global object, you could set a flag in there, actually.
You could have a state object,
if you like, that's defined in your app.xaml that is global to the app. You'd set a value in there and you could read it then when you're on navigated to the page that you end up in.
You could
look for that value to figure out if you've come back from somewhere else.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's great, fine. So anyway, let's think about this situation here. So if you've got you've normal case of things, you start with your main page and you'll navigate to another page, which in this example is called second page, and then you navigate to another page that's called third page. Now, maybe you want to, at this point, maybe in your application, what you really want is to have a button on third page that allows you to go back to the home page. Now, how do you do that? You can't say navigationService.goBack from third page because you'll end up on
second page. Yeah.
So, obviously, what you need to do is go navigationService.navigate and give the URI of main page. So you end up in main page. But then think about this. What happens then if the user hits the back key? The user would expect, because you're on main page, the app exits. Mm. This is what happens when you hit the back key on the main page of an app. The app exits. This is the only way, incidentally, short of having an unhandled exception.
Sort of crashing.
You're crashing it. It's the only supported way of exiting a Windows Phone app is the user hits the back key on the main page.
Yeah. Although.
But.
Yeah.
If you're on main page, if you think of the history stack now, the history stack is on the bottom, we've got main page. Then we've got second page, and above that we've got third page, and now we've just navigated to main page again. So we've got another instance of main page sitting on the top. So when they navigate back from this main page, expecting the app to exit, actually what happens is they end up back on third page again. So this has been a problem in 7.0. If you're still writing 7.0 apps, although they're now accepting submissions for Mango apps as of yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But if you're still doing some Windows Phone 7.0 development, there is on App Hub a recipe called the non-linear navigation recipe library, which makes it's kind of relatively easy to handle this kind of situation. In actual fact, what it does is it looks at your navigation path, and if you're going to this exact situation where you're doing a circular thing and going back to main page, what it actually does is navigationService.goBacks to unwind the stack for you, without you having to worry about it. Otherwise, you have to code that sort of thing yourself. So that's the 7.0 answer for this. Bit messy. However, in 7.5, there is a new API specifically targeting this particular scenario, which is navigationService.removeBackEntry. So this can get very complicated, so you have to use this carefully, but you have to think about the ways your user is going to navigate through the application. But some remove back entries, specifically for this scenario, would be a way of unwinding the navigation stack in code.
I must admit, at this point, I think I'd design my app so the pages are structured in a way that makes it not do that, so you can effectively guide the user through the process.
Well, exactly, and that's really why the first bullet point on that slide says design your app navigation strategy carefully. So that's an important message.
Too many links is maybe a bad thing.
Indeed. So there you go. This is an example of remove back entry. When third page navigates back to main page, you can put a marker in the query string, put something in the query string. So then in the on navigated to in main page, it can have a look in the navigation context.query string to see if this marker, this flag is in there. And if it is, then it knows that actually, oh, hey, I've just been navigated to from page 3. I know now I need to fix this problem I've got with the navigation stack. So it will do, in this particular instance, the example, it would do two calls to navigationService.removeBackEntry to get us back to the right situation in the history stack that the user would actually expect to find. So after all of that, quite complex on that, I've actually got a very simple demo to just draw a couple of those little threads together. So I'm going to share my desktop. So that should be coming up for you now. Now here's a little app, which was a sample that's been kicking around for ages. It was in the Windows Phone training kit that came out last year. So there's a couple of interesting features on this. It shows use of a pivot page, There's some buttons on there for navigating, but actually what we want to do is put an application bar on this as well, because this app has a common design and has the application bar on all the pages that allows you to navigate between these different things. So it allows you to go to Twitter trends and then look at the look at the pages, the top Twitter trends at the moment.
Got an application bar question just to... Can you change the colour of the buttons on the application bar, is the question. It's from John, I think.
Yeah, I think if you by default you can, but you would be sort of you would be going away from the Metro design style for which you'll be shot. So
that's not true. We won't actually shoot you. No, but you might disappear.
Yeah, indeed. So yes, you can. You can put your own icons in, and they can be what you like. However, the design style guidelines say that they should be monochrome. Essentially,
I think there's some things that they are quite determined about in terms of look and feel.
Having said that, I've seen apps with coloured buttons, and used carefully, that can make a nice distinguishing feature. So,
okay,
yeah. Okay. Now then, so here's our app. This is a default. If you create an app with using the tools, by default you already get this at the bottom. You've even got the XAML here to show you how to create your app bar. So we could simply uncomment this. And immediately we get ourselves an app bar. Now this is, you see on the left of the screen there, now we've got just these round circles. But the icons, well actually by default we've got the icons / images app bar button 1.png. So you could, if you know where your icons are, where exactly are their resources. So here we go. So we could actually go in and edit this. So it goes and finds the right one, and then we've got app dot, what's the first one, dot dig dot png, and that would actually point, that is pointing at the right thing, but actually even so you still don't see it in the designer in Visual Studio. So this is one of those things where I like to work in Blend. So I'm actually going to delete the menu items. Anyway, I don't want them. There's no menu on this. It's just buttons. Put false on that. And then, having done that, I'm just going to save everything. And now I'm just going to switch quickly into Expression Blend. I can right-click on any XAML file, and you can say Open in Expression Blend, and it will automatically will start the designer tool up in the right place. And allows us to look at the same project from a kind of more of a designer point of view. So let's just shrink this a bit. So there you are. Actually, you can see that actually in here we've got that image has been set up appropriately. So I want to set this other one up as well. So we can set the properties. We can highlight the phone application page in here, and we see we've got the application bar here. So we can edit this. Here's our application bar as well. And you can see the properties of the application bar, and there's a buttons collection here, so we can go in and edit our buttons. So here's the second one. So we can go and find the here's the ones in the project, so we can just go and pick the one that we want. So let's go and have the Twitter one on that for the second application bar button. I can now going to add yet another button onto this as well. So there we go, and stick another button onto this. And there's the icon URI, and we can put the text on that. That would be one to go to the blog, put the text on it, it's enabled. And then the icon URI, and we could pick one from our project, which I'm going to do in a minute. But actually, if you hit this ellipsis button as well, and you get all the standard icons, and here they are, they're white on an invisible background, so you have to kind of hover over them before you can see them. So those are the standard ones. However, in this case, I am going to use one of the custom ones that's already in this project. So let's put that on as well. So there's Blend being used, and there we are, and you can see it. So it's actually a better experience than in Visual Studio. Just going to build it so it saves all the changes. And then we're going to switch back to here and reload it in Visual Studio. So you can switch between the two. It's not a problem. And we can put a bit more, we can actually put a name on this, so X colon, that's a namespace indicator, and we'll put a name on it, and the first one will be called app bar button dig, and then we put a name on this guy as well, and that's going to be app bar button Twitter, and so on. It's always good to put names on them because the default ones are not very informative. Button blog, and so on. And then we can actually go into the events, and we can put a click event on it. Let's do that one, actually. Double click on here. And then this is where you want to navigate to a different page. Navigation service dot navigate, and then we go to a new URI.
We have a question about URIs, and that you do have to make a URI to drive navigation, not just a string. That's great, isn't it? Basically, another question on this as well. If you make your own design for the application bar, your own PNGs, it'll change the colours to match if you use white with transparent for the colour scheme, won't it?
It will. Yeah. Yes, you just do them white on a black on a transparent background, and the system will take care of that for you.
Excellent.
And let's put one on this guy as well. Navigation service. I'm just going to copy and paste that. Save a bit of time. But this one is going to go to the Twitter page.
Another question from somebody.
And I'm going to run it.
Can you edit the XAML file actually in Expression? The implication of the messages that.
Absolutely, you can. So while that's starting up, if here's the designer in XAML. You're seeing the design view in here, but over here we can split the view and there's the XAML. So
okay, absolutely.
You can, yeah. Or you can go just to the XAML, or you can go just to the designer. So
yeah, so it's in the resources panel you do that, yeah.
Yeah, just on just on the right-hand side of the designer there, you just click the little buttons and you switch between different views of it. Same's true in Visual Studio. Now, our app is deploying it to the emulator. And I said that this was an example. So here's our... This one should navigate now to the Twitter Trends page. Oh, I got the wrong page. That's not good. So I want to just correct that. Trends page. Again. So deploy the updated one, and there we go to our Twitter trends, and now it's loading the trends. This is always slightly worrying from a live demo point of view, because this is live, because you never know what's going to be on there.
Heaven forbid, are we on there?
Then when you click on one of these, what it switches to now, and this is kind of interesting, is a pivot page. So you can see we're currently on Hurricane Irene, so there's the tweets that are about that on the top Twitter trends. And then we can just switch it across in the next pivot page. It's dynamic. This is an example of dynamically adding pivot pages to a pivot control. So it depends, obviously, the content is being built according to the current trends that it's read off from a feed on the web. So, and there we got, and I've actually got the tweets under there. And actually, if you look, you'll see a little progress bar appearing when we go to it. So it's only loading the page on demand. So that's a nice design feature as well. So you can get all the code for that. So there you go. So a quick example of pivot and navigation.
And again, all this code is going out there?
It is indeed.
So, I mean,
and this is the home page. Hit the back key and bang, your app exits.
Style question from Greg. He reckons, should you name all the elements in XAML or just the ones you put code behind? It's a how long is a piece of string question in my book.
Kind of depends on the coding standards of your particular place, really.
I think it's a style question, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the question really is, if you're binding events to things, they have to have a name. If they're just there to say, put something here, then whether they have a name or not, it's immaterial. They can just sit in the system.
From a personal point of view, it offends me to see lots of text block 1, test block 2 and text block 3s in there. So, you know, but that's kind of a personal decision.
I think everything should have a name, but that's just me.
Indeed.
So my style would be, yes, put a name on everything. And you can talk about it and know what it is.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to get my skates on here. Yes, data binding. This is a big topic. So... So in Rob's very fine, what was it called? The calculator app.
Yes,
the calculator app. Yes. So Rob's was a very fine effort for a beginner. we're hoping he gets beyond beginner soon.
Oh, goody. Yeah. Yes.
But actually, as a beginner, what you tend to do is you'll set properties in your code. The obvious thing if you want to do is you want to display something on a control. You'd put textbot1.text equals whatever. You put the total.text is equal to whatever the result of the calculation was. And that's okay for simple apps, but in complex applications, when you start getting a bit more pages and that sort of thing, your code quickly becomes very unwieldy and it becomes error-prone. So it's hard to maintain and it's kind of difficult. Now, what data binding is all about is about avoiding these explicit setting of properties. And instead, in XAML, you'll put some XAML in there that says, I'm data binding this field to a property of some class somewhere. And then that some class somewhere is something we call a view model. And you have a class within your application that is its purpose is simply to store the data for your application. It means your code can change the properties of that data class and the UI will automatically update. And you have the option to configure it to do the reverse as well. The user can enter some value into a text box and it will automatically set the appropriately data bound property in the background class. And then logic runs. So this is a technique that is highly recommended, and you really should be using this for your applications. Even as a beginner, you need to get to know this. So this is an example of if you were in XAML, this text block called with a name of content text. If you wanted that text to be something that was static and always displayed the same, you just put the text in there. Text equals hello world or whatever. But if it's dynamic, then what you want to do is bind it to a backing store, a data class. And you do that with this binding statement. You'll see there in the curly brackets, you've got text equals binding line 3. So what this is saying is that this text property is bound to a property in some class somewhere, which is the name line 3. And the mode there means, are we reading simply from the backing data store? So one way means, yes, we're just reading it. So if this is a text block anyway, which is a non-data entry field, but if it was a text box, the user could enter it. But if it was mode equals one way, then it wouldn't update the backing store.
It's a window. It's where you can look at things but not change them.
Yep. So that's the essential bit on the XAML side of things. Now then, the modes, as I said, one time means that the UI control, simply goes and fetches the value of the backing class at the time it is data bound, and thereafter ignores any changes in that backing class. One way means that it will read it when it's data bound, and also any time that the code changes that property in the backing class, it will automatically update the UI. And the two-way one is where it works both ways. So if it's a user-enterable field, they can enter some value, and that also gets written away to the backing class. And the magic that makes this work, this is an example of a view model, and your view model classes have to implement this interface called iNotifyPropertyChanged, which is a very, very simple interface. In fact, all it is a public event called PropertyChanged. Of the delegate being property changed event handler. So it must fire this property changed event any time a setter on one of the properties in this class is called by anywhere.
This is how Silverlight knows you've changed something.
Yep.
Silverlight connects to the thing saying, if you change a value, tell me about it by hitting this event, and then your thing can then hit that event when the user changes a number or the program reads data from the value from the net.
Yep.
This thing then fires and kicks the Silverlight into action.
Yep.
This is the glue.
This is the glue. This is the essential thing. So here we've got an example of a setter on a property called line 1. And you'll notice that in the setter logic, the last thing it does is calls notify property changed. And the argument it passes is the textual, the name of the property, line 1. So the Silverlight runtime, meanwhile, is sitting there and it has subscribed to these events. So it picks up this, it gets an event, it gets this event firing, it receives the event, and it looks at the argument, which is line 1, and it knows that anything that's data bound to line 1 needs to go and fetch the value. So it calls the getter on this class. So this is the mechanism that makes it work. Lists have a similar thing. So they have a property called item source, and that needs to be set to a collection of objects. So there is this thing you'll come across time and time again in Silverlight called an observable collection, which essentially is a collection of objects.
That can be observed.
That can be observed. Exactly. That fires. It actually fires collection changed events. So when you add and remove items from the collection, an event will get fired. And also the individual items in that collection also need to implement iNotify property change. So the whole data binding thing works. It will pick up changes not only to the collection, but also to individual items in that collection.
And this is wonderful stuff because basically it means you can get a whole bunch of things down from the interwebs or whatever and just display them like that.
Yeah, so here's a main view model. So you'll see that this is an observable collection, has a public property on it, observable collection item view model with an items thing. So that is something that a list could data bind to, the property called items on this main view model class. It doesn't need to fire on the setter, it doesn't need to fire the iNotify collection change. It's kind of inherent in the observable collection.
That's what the observable part does.
Now, I have to mention briefly, there's some debate about how much to say about this, but MVVM is the model that really this what we're talking about here, model view view model. So you'll come across this term a lot. So it's an architectural pattern that employs data binding, and it's one of these, it's not quite a religious war thing, but there are different, you can kind of implement data binding and still be kind of doing MVVM, or you can go the whole hog and really have a very strict architectural pattern called MVVM, which even has this idea that you don't have event handlers on a button. Instead, that is data bound to somewhere that handles it. So this is something that there's a link there, and there's a very well known and very respected toolkit called MVVM Lite. And the bottom link on that, galasoft.ch. Laurent Bunion has created this, and it's very widely used. If you're interested in good patterns and you really want to take this to its extreme, if you like, that's unfair, but you should look at this stuff. The only warning note I would mention is that heavyweight architectural patterns have never been sat very well with mobile devices. Mobile devices are inherently low-powered. They're inherently, because of the nature of them, they're battery-powered. They have lower power processors than desktop Silverlight. And time and time again, we've had situations where a highfalutin architectural toolkit has been released for mobile, and then it comes to little surprise to us that it doesn't actually perform
very
well.
Runs very slowly. I mean, this is the thing. All this binding sits in the way, and on a desktop, no worries.
MVVM Lite, to be fair, is very good and lightweight and is good, but just be careful of heavyweight architectures on mobile. So, a quick demo. Well, not such a quick demo. It's the return of Damage Calc. Woohoo!
Oh, yes, this is a way in which you can type in how much money. It's a bit like adding a machine with a twist, and it'll actually take in how much money you want to spend and tell you how much that is in a different currency, including sales tax. And it has a special place in our hearts because we used it last year for the work. And the idea is that we're going to bind the boxes. If you look at the thing very carefully, you'll find there's no button to actually say, do the sum now, please, because it effectively, the data is bound to the elements in the text components. So when you change the numbers, the binding does the work, not the user. So there's no need to press a button and say, do the sum. All we have to do is just change the contents of the box, and the data binding does the rest. So if Andy clicks outside the...
Well, except that this doesn't work at the moment. It's a non-functional version of this.
Okay.
It's broken at the moment.
It's the starting point.
It's the starting point. So, the idea is you put a value in dollars, and it will show us to us poor limers, it will show us the equivalent in pounds. So
the damage, as it were.
The damage.
Damage.
The damage gov,
It was a damage gov.
So let's just finish this app off. I've already got in this app a view model. Here's my damage view model class. Implements iNotify property changed. There's the implementation of that. And we've got a property on here. When I typed into the price, what we want is this setter to be called. It will calculate the damage. This is the logic that actually calculates the equivalent. It's a very sophisticated app. Actually, it has a hard-coded exchange rate, but there's some room for improvement.
An exercise for the viewer.
And here it fires the property changed event. In actual fact, it's firing the property changed on damage, not price, which is kind of odd. But that's because the damage property in this class has been updated as a result of the setter.
The sum being
of price, yeah, that's right. OK, so that's the view model logic. So this now is a nice class that contains all our logic for this application. The reverse is true. You can put something into damage and it will give you the equivalent in dollars. So that it's a pretty useful little app. And this is where all our logic is now. Now then, we need to start adding some data binding here. So I'm going to go into the main page.xaml here. Drag this across so we can see this.
Our class is all ready to go. We haven't wired it up to our display objects yet.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
So text equals, and then I'm going to put in a binding statement. So there's IntelliSense helping out on there. Binding, and then we're going to put let's put mode equals two-way because we want it to be two ways. And we want to say path equals, this is another way of expressing the property in the underlying class that we want is price. So that's the price one. Similar thing here, text equals binding, mode equals two-way again.
That's so that they can type in numbers and the program can display numbers.
Yeah, that's right. And path equals, and this one is bound to the damage field. Now, that in itself, okay, we've put a binding statement on there, but at the moment we haven't said what it's binding to in any way. The simple way of doing that is simply in the code behind. So code beside, I never know what to call it.
The other code.
Yeah. This dot loaded. Equals. Why does it never do that? I've got this weird.
So now we're going to have an event that fires when the page is loaded, because as Andy said earlier, this is when you can do all your twiddling with the components.
Yeah.
So Andy is now actually using the within the code to do this.
I think my Visual Studio is broken, so let me just do it another way. I'll do it as a inline. Send args to. I'm going to put my logic in here. Oh, dear. Oh, there we go.
I think we might be buying each other drinks here.
Yeah, I think so. so we can say this dot data context. So we set the data context on the page is equal to a new instance of my damage view model.
Yeah, this is effectively, we've linked the components, but the components don't know what the thing is that they're supposed to be tied to. And this is the linking that we're doing now.
It's one way of doing it. There's other ways of doing it. All right. So there we go. So now if I run it. I can put in. Let's put in 300. There's some challenges on here. And there you can see it's come up with actually a totally erroneous value.
That looks about right. $300 is 209 quid.
Oh, OK, that is right, yes.
So have faith. Have faith in your price.
OK.
Yes.
Now, in the code, there's a more sophisticated version of this that we're going to ship you, which also does something with a thing called type converters, which is an if the type doesn't quite fit between your backing class and the UI.
You mean if a string goes in but you want a number?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Or you can actually do all sorts of things, like you can bind the visibility property of to whether a value is high or low. So, in the sample we've got something which shows a warning message if it's over a certain value, if the damage is over a certain value. So that's quite a nice sample, but I haven't got time to show that now, but that'll be in the code that you'll be able to download. So, simple example of data binding there, and hopefully you can see that the logic ends up nicely contained in a class, and you end up with a much better organized application, one that's more maintainable. So, I just want to talk very quickly, in about 2 minutes, about the Silverlight Toolkit. So, this is an add-ons for the control set. It comes out of the Microsoft Silverlight team, but it's released out of band. So it allows them a process of releasing stuff every 3 months or so that is outside of the big release cycle, which is harder for them which has more stringent quality things. So they're very, very good controls, loads of extra stuff in it. The new one came out just last week, You can get it, download it from Codeplex, silverlight.codeplex.com. You can go and download all the source, so it's great as well if you want to learn how to build custom controls. You can get all of that. But the recommended way of doing it is with NuGet, which is a package management system for .NET. It's an add-in which allows you to easily download dependencies and then plug them into your application.
NuGet is wonderful. If you just two or three things to take away from this, one of them is get NuGet, because it's ace. There's loads of stuff out there, and it's all great.
So you get all sorts of great stuff that aren't in the normal control set, like context menu, and like date time pickers and time pickers. I'm going to fly through these, toggle switch. And actually, there's a whole bunch that released last week that aren't in these slides. There's masses of stuff in it. And the long list selector, which is the a very nice, gives you jump lists, combo box equivalent, the list picker. But the most interesting one, if you like, is how we can do these animations. And I've got a very quick little demo that will show you how this works. So page transitions. So this is about bringing your app to life and giving it the kind of the normal built-in Windows Phone transitions when you're switching from page to page. This is what you need to do. You declare the namespace for the Silverlight Toolkit assembly after you've added it to your project. And then you put in that XAML there. And there's also tilt effect, which gives a kind of a 3D
When you move
effect.
The phone, you can see the shadow behind it sliding around. It looks really sweet. It's very, very impressive.
It's very nice, yeah. And the easiest way of showing this is to just...
Now, these are basically big lumps of XAML that you can drop into anything you like or modify or fiddle with. But it means if you've got a particular application you want to pick a date and time or select from a big list, don't write your own, fun though it would be. Find the one that they've made for you. This is why they do this.
So I'm going to create a new data-bound application, data-bound app 8, that'll do. So this is using the data-bound template. I'm going to create it for 7.1. And out of the box, it works, but it's kind of a bit dull. It doesn't really have much in the way of life about it. So it displays a list of records, and then you just go to the details page. But you see it just bounces between. There's no animations or anything. No finesse, no. But we can very, very easily add some finesse. So I've already installed NuGet on my system. And once you do this, you get this Manage NuGet Packages. So I'm going off to the web now. It's finding, first of all, it's looking at my recent packages, all the ones I've used on projects over the last few months, so you can see what I've been up to. And the one, Silverlight for Windows Phone Toolkit, is the top one. So I'm going to install that into my project. And there we go. It's now been added as a dependency. There is Microsoft.phone.controls.toolkit there. And then I'm just going to add onto this, I'm going to go into main page. We're already there. Duh. I need to define a namespace called toolkit.
This is effectively to tell the system where to go to fetch the...
And then we have to go and find the assembly, which is the Microsoft.phone.controls, which is the toolkit one. Now, the reason why I've done that is because what we're going to do and plug in now is, hopefully... The gods are with me at the bottom here. A block of XAML that's in here. There we go. So now that toolkit namespace has been defined. So that is the basic stuff for the navigation. There's one other thing I have to do. It's down in my app.xaml in here. One other thing, piece of magic, and you always forget this. So when you do this and it doesn't work, you've probably forgotten to do this. change the basic the frame, right? So this is the, down in here we've got the initialized phone application, which you don't normally need to look at. And the default is the phone application frame. But what you need to do is change that to a transition frame.
And this is the thing which will have the animation
and
behaviors.
This is the one that understands those animation behaviors. Now, I would normally go and put one on the detail page as well. So I've only put it on main page.
So it'll only do animation one way but not back, is that correct?
Yes. So we'll get inwards and outwards navigation on here. So if you watch closely, I don't know if this will come out on live meeting, but if I hit one of these now and then go back, you can see a page flip effect, which I say on live meeting because of the speed of transmission, you probably won't see. But trust me, it's folding in and out.
We are live meeting. We are recording the desktop. We're doing all kinds of scary stuff. Yeah. Trust me, I've just seen it work on his desktop. I'm an honest person, so... Absolutely fine.
So that's the basics of that. And tilt effect is very easy to add as well with a button. And this, you actually see it kind of looks like a 3D presses
in. It's very impressive.
It's very nice and very, very simple.
Simple, easy things you can do that'll make your application better than the other guys.
Yep.
So that gives you your selling points, which is nice.
So there we go. That's kind of a nice, easy win for your things. Now, in the deck, we've got. I'm going to have to leave gesture support, so I'm going to go and jump straight to the review. There is gesture support as well. I've got a nice demo that does pinch and things. So just a review of what we've done in this hour and almost an hour. Navigation to pages is performed on the basis of URIs, and the back button normally navigates back in the navigation stack, but you can override this if it's appropriate for the state of your URI at the time. You can actually pass query strings in the URI, and although I don't say it there, of course, you can pass indexes into data collections, like a view model that's been created globally that's in your app.xaml.
Okay, we have a bunch of questions queued up. We also have not much time on this one. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit here and answer the questions tippy-tappy-typey all the way through the next break. So if you have a question outstanding, we will get to you.
It is a complicated. There's always loads of questions about data mining, but it's so worthwhile you really mastering this, because your applications will end up better organized and more maintainable. Silverlight Toolkit, I showed you very quickly. Loads of great stuff in there. You really want to go and get that. And of course, the data binding again just is the way to hook your UI up to your data. All right, good. Well. Thanks for that whirlwind tour through a lot of good stuff that builds on the essentials for Silverlight application development. We're going to be back in 10 minutes, and then I'm going to look a little bit, dig a bit more deeply into what the sort of fun things you can do with Expression Blend. So we'll see you then.